You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. This is the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio across on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide by the Free Speech TV Network. More people are watching or listening to the Tom Hartman Program on more stations and more outlets than any other progressive show, radio show in the world. And speaking of which, last night on our TV show, which is a whole separate thing, which we do for Free Speech TV and out of the networks of RT, we had on this is fascinating. Chuck Slatkin was with us, the legislative and political director of the New York Metro Area Postal Union. You can see the video of that over at tomhartman.com. Chuck made some excellent points. Due to the constraints of television, you know, sometimes it's hard to get it all in, right? And so I wanted a little bit longer form. Here we have 7 or 8 minutes instead of 4.5, 5. Chuck, welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Thank you. It's great to have you. I want to just get right to this. What's going on here with what we're hearing in the media, what we saw in the New York Times yesterday or the day before, the Washington Post, is that the post office is going broke. It turns out that this is, to the extent that this is true, it is because of a piece of poison pill legislation in 2006 that was promoted by Tom DeLay, Dennis Hastert, and Tom Davis, all the Republican politicians who took large campaign contributions from the United Postal Service, or the Parcel Service, rather, UPS, among others. What's the deal here? What is this legislation? What's the bizarre circumstance that the United States Postal Service has to deal with that no other government agency or corporation has to deal with?
Yes, Tom. Well, what this legislation did is it mandated that the Postal Service, I mean, it's hard to understand this. It's not even logical, but to fully pre-fund future retirees' health benefits for the next 75 years, and it had to be done within a 10-year window.
So,
bottom line, oh, go ahead.
So through this 10-year window, which we're halfway through right now, we are paying for the benefits of people who have not yet even been born, much less gone to work for the post office. Typically, retirees are getting benefits that they themselves paid in for. But these workers right now are paying for the retirement benefits of people who have not yet been born. Do I have that right?
Yes, so the Postal Service, every September 30th, when they talk about a $5.5 billion payment that the Postal Service says it can't make, it's this particular payment.
Wow.
That means that the Postal Service, before they sell one stamp or one money order, is $5.5 billion in the hole every year. This was created with no logical sense for the benefit of the Postal Service or the American people. What it did is it put this tremendous weight on the Postal Service. So when they talk about the Postal Service losing money, that's a big lie. In fact, even with email and even with the economic collapse in 2008, the Postal Service would be fine. There would be no need to close post offices, cut back on services, and lay off hundreds of thousands of workers.
Right. So why did now this piece of legislation had a very friendly name to it, something like the Postal Reconciliation Act or whatever. It had
Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act,
right?
In 2006.
And when Denny Hastert brought it to a vote, he said, "All say aye. All in favor say aye." Lots of people said aye. All the nays. There weren't that many nays. He says it's passed. Typically, somebody then at that point stands up and says, I want a roll call vote, so there's a record of who voted how. But Denny Hastert chose not to do that, either because they were trying to slip something through or because everybody thought, hey, this is just some pro forma, you know, like naming a post office kind of thing. What was the deal here? I mean, this poison, were there people warning about this at the time, or did this really, did Congress get snookered?
Well, I think Congress and a large part of the American people and media were snookered. The American Postal Workers Union, my national union, we opposed it from the get-go. We saw the problems ahead, but this went through. It was the last day of the session of that Congress. People voted on this thing, and they went home for Christmas. That's what it was about. That's what was taking place. And it went through, and now at that time, people thought, well, the Postal Service at that point was running in the black. It could absorb this. But then with the economic collapse of 2008, it really put it behind the eight ball, and it is the sole reason that this crisis is supposedly taking place right now. In addition to this, over the decades, the Postal Service has overpaid the employee share into the civil service retirement system to the tune of at least $50 billion. This was the figure that the audit by the Postal Regulatory Commission, they did an independent audit, and they said $50 to $60 billion overpayment. The Postal Service should be credited that money immediately, which would eliminate all these financial problems by paying off every year the $5.5 billion for the rest of that requirement.
Right.
And then the additional money of that $50 to $60 billion could pay down the debt, modernize the Postal Service, and make a 236-year-old institution even be stronger.
Right. So we're talking with Chuck Zlatkin. He's the legislative and political director of the New York Metro Area Postal Union, the APWU of the AFL-CIO. And the big picture here is that conservatives and to some extent, and Republicans has enthusiastically, and to some extent the national media are buying into this notion that the post office is dying and needs to go through radical transformations and possibly even death in order to be saved. This is going to inure tremendous benefit to UPS and FedEx. And given that there are now, we're talking billions and billions of dollars in pension funds and health fund benefits, it may also produce enormous benefits for Wall Street. We have another manufactured crisis here. And so, Chuck, what, first of all, before we get to what can be done about it, we've got about 2 minutes left here. There is a piece of legislation that will fix. I'm sorry, we have 1 minute left. There's a piece of legislation that will fix this. What should people be calling their representatives and calling for?
Okay, H.R. 1351, which will reconcile the overpayment to the future debt and basically free up the $5.5 billion a year to the Postal Service. H.R. 1351, introduced by Stephen Lynch, right now as of today has 193 co-sponsors. Democrats and some Republicans. I would suggest everybody to call up their congressional representative, and if they haven't signed on as a co-sponsor, suggest that they do. Because if we get to 218 co-sponsors, that means the majority of the Congress is co-sponsoring, and how can the Republican chair of the House Oversight and Reform Committee, Daryl Issa, prevent it from coming to a vote. That's
right.
What we need. We need everybody to call their congressional representatives today and say support 1351, H.R. 1351, and bring it to the floor for a vote.
And Daryl Issa right now is the guy who's blocking this thing up, right?
Yes, he has another piece of legislation that would basically destroy the Postal Service. He calls it a Reform Act. Basically, it should be called the Wisconsining of the Postal Service Act. Because that's what he's trying
this
to do.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Absolutely amazing. Chuck Zlatkin, APWU.org. But call your member of Congress, H.R. 1351. Call Congress.org has the phone numbers. Thanks, Chuck.
Thank you, Tom.
Wait, oh yes, wait a minute, Mr. Postman. Wait, wait, hey, 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 Mr. Postman. Mr. Postman, look at me.
Let me tell you what's really going on here, okay? This this whole thing with the post offices and Mitt Romney's job speech and Barack Obama and tonight the Republican debate and tomorrow Barack Obama's job speech, which looks like it's going to be $300 billion, much of it tax cuts. I'm very concerned it's going that he has put himself into a corner here, the president has, because he played right into the Jude Wininski to Santa Claus Republican strategy when he took office and immediately started agreeing with the Republicans that the deficit was a problem rather than going after jobs. You remember Jude Wininski's two Santa Claus theory put forward in the mid-1970s and put into place during the Reagan administration was very simple. When a Republican is president, borrow like crazy, spend on the national credit card to stimulate the economy, Keynesian economics on steroids, only done wrong. Borrow on the national credit card, spend like crazy to stimulate the economy, claim credit for the great economy, and then as soon as a Democrat comes into office, start screaming about all the debt that the previous Republican presidents ran up and demand that that Democratic president do something about that debt. And that the something that he do about that debt doesn't involve raising taxes. In other words, slash social programs. Or kill off the post office. Privatize things. Sell off the national parks. Sell off the monuments. Sell, you know, anything. Right? Just go for it. But the larger picture here is one that nobody's talking about. I've been talking about this for years, but let me just be very explicit about this. There is a social compact, a contract, if you will, a relationship between the government of we the people and we the people. And because that government defines the rules of the game of business and the rules of the game of economics, from the 1930s, when that contract, when that social contract was first put into place, I mean, it was first declared in 1912 by Teddy Roosevelt. It was called the Square Deal. And when it was first put into place in the 1930s, here's basically what it was. It was that if you graduate from high school and you enter the job force and you keep your nose clean and you're a good citizen, and then you will be able to get a job that pays enough that you can become the American middle class. I had my dentist. I went in this morning to get a tooth fixed, which turned into more of a project than either of us had expected. But in any case, before he said, oops, he made a comment about, well, at least, in Detroit, they're now paying people $15 an hour instead of $30 an hour to stand in an assembly line and do simple manual labor. Now, think about that for a minute. This is, from an educated guy in his 30s who's probably a Republican. What he's essentially saying is an expression of the new social contract. Now, the old social contract, the reason why auto workers make $30 an hour or used to make $30 an hour is because that's what it took to have a middle class life in America. And what that meant was that the rich had to pay a little higher in taxes. The CEOs didn't get as big a paycheck. The stockholders didn't get as much in dividends. Everybody was doing fine. But the really rich weren't right now you have 400 people in America who own more wealth than the bottom 150 million in America. In the last 10 years, their wealth has tripled. I mean, this is mind-boggling, right? And where has that money come from? It's come out of the middle class. And what we find now is that people who grew up in the American middle class, one in three of the people who grew up in the American middle class, which would basically be the boomer generation, because that was the generation of the American middle class and their parents, although their parents are dying off. One in three of those people has now fallen out of the middle class and into the working poor class. And this is what my dentist was saying, basically, was, you know, why should people who just have a high school diploma, who haven't gone to dental school or whatever, why should they be middle class? Why shouldn't they just be the working poor? I mean, they don't deserve anything more than that. And that's the new social contract that was put into place by Ronald Reagan when he said to the Patco workers, basically, you know, you guys, you want to have a union, you want to take us on, fine. We're gonna squash you. We're going to crush you. And when these union guys get out there, we had James Hoffa on the show yesterday. When the union guys get out there and they say, you know, we're going to fight for decent wages for working people, they've got much of the nation now, after 30 years of this steady drumbeat by Reagan saying, wait a minute, you guys are overpaid. You don't deserve to be in the middle class. You're just working people. That's the message that is being put out. And instead, the middle class should go back to what it was during Victorian era England, when Charles Dickens was writing about it. You know, basically the doctors and the lawyers and the dentists and the shop owners. Scrooge and Marley, a small business. That should be the middle class. And everybody else should be the working poor. That's the new social contract, that you have the right to be the working poor. And by the way, if you think that college is going to get out of it, I got a surprise for you right after this break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Because graduating from college, well, I'll tell you after the break. Stick.
Stick it in the mailbox. Why don't you stick it in the mailbox and I'll give it to you when I can.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here back with you. This is what everybody is missing. That we had a social contract in the United States. At the founding of this country, it lasted up until around the Civil War. And then it reemerged with the progressive era in the 1890s. And then it, you know, kind of died out with World War One. And then it reemerged after the Great Crash in 1929. And through the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and into the early 80s, the social contract was, if you work hard, you get a decent job, you work hard, you help build our manufacturing, you can work in a factory, and you can make enough money to raise a family, to put your kids through school. You'll have health care. You'll have a pension. You'll have, you know, retirement after 30 years. You will have a decent job. And we're going to mirror those decent jobs with the government jobs as well. And over the last 30 years of Reaganomics, what Reaganomics did, what Ronald Reagan did, and not really just Reagan, it was the philosophers of the era, the conservative philosophers. The Reagan Revolution was genuinely a revolution. Because it rolled back, or it fought back against that concept of the American dream. That average working people could be middle class. And so now under Reaganomics, average working people no longer have the right to be middle class. They have the right to be the working poor class. And about a third of them, since Reagan was elected, about a third of the middle-class Americans have dropped into the category of the working poor. I mean, this is setting aside the economic, you know, George Bush's Great Depression of 2008, setting aside all that stuff. This is just the larger trend. So a high school diploma doesn't make it anymore. Okay, so people get that, and they say, all right, so I get it. Times have changed. High school diploma doesn't make it anymore. Now, if I want to be middle class, I have to have a college diploma. Last year, college debt, money borrowed to go to college, exceeded the combined debt of everybody with a credit card in the United States, over $1 trillion. Now, my mom, back in the 40s, went to Michigan State University, and put herself through school propping planes at the Lansing Airport on weekends and as a lifeguard up in Charlevoix, Michigan in the summers. Graduated magna cum laude, the whole bit, and her mother, her father had died when she was 13. She had no money. Her mom was the town clerk up in Charlevoix, Michigan. I mean, here she was. She put herself through school as a lifeguard, basically, and propping planes, starting firing up airplanes. Ronald Reagan put himself through college, through Eureka College in Illinois, around the same time as my mom. A little earlier, actually, but a decade earlier. He was actually in college in 1929 when the crash happened. My mom, that was around the time she was being born. But in any case, Ronald Reagan put himself through college, working as a lifeguard in the summers. When Louise and I went to college, and I did not graduate, but going to college, she put herself through college as a waitress at a Howard Johnson's. On tips. I pumped gas at a gas station. I was making $2.35 an hour as a weekend DJ at a country western station. And I worked as a dishwasher and then a chef at Bob's Big Boy on Trowbridge Road in East Lansing, Michigan. You could put yourself through college back then that way. In fact, in California, before Ronald Reagan took an axe to it, you could go to college for free. But back in 1980, when Reagan came into office, you know, MSU was charging $23 a credit hour. It's now like $450 a credit hour. So it used to be that not only could you, with a high school diploma, have that middle class life, that American dream, but it used to be also that your kids could become the first generation to have a college diploma or degree or an advanced degree. I mean, it's a pretty amazing thing when you think about it. My dad dropped out of college because my mom got pregnant with me. His parents, he would have been the first college graduate in his family. Now, my mom, she had a bunch of them in her family. Her family goes back to the Daughters of the American Revolution, but, you know, her family had lost everything in the Great Depression. My dad was the son of immigrants from Norway. And so, you know, when our oldest daughter graduated from college, it was like, hey, the first college graduate in the family. And then our son, you know, got a master's. Holy cow, this is incredible stuff. But when you graduate from college with a $50,000 or $60,000 or $80,000 or $100,000 debt, even if you get that so-called middle-class job, you got to pay off that debt. You're still the working poor. Maybe for the rest of your life. So the social contract changed from, and this is what you're going to hear in code in the Republican debate tonight and all the Republican discussions. And frankly and tragically, I don't think even a lot of Democrats have figured this out. And a lot of people in the labor movement, I mean, they see this sea change. They see the earth changing underneath them. They're not sure why. They don't get it that the social contract has changed. That it used to be the idea that working people were entitled to middle-class lives. That has gone by the wayside. It's being held onto by a few aging boomers who remember it well, and the labor movement. And a few Democratic politicians and a few, you know, Democratic socialists like Bernie Sanders and me. The idea that we should go back to a social contract that says, you know, our billionaires aren't going to be quite so rich. Our CEOs are not going to be quite so rich. Our stockholders are not going to be able to make their living sitting around the pool waiting for the dividend checks to arrive and only paying 15% income tax. But we will have a strong middle class. people doing manufacturing work, people doing, you know, a basic good job that they're going to do day in and day out, year after year for 5, 10, 15, 20 years and retire. Those people are going to be paid well enough that they can actually buy a house, put their kids through school, have health insurance, take a vacation, get a pension, retire with dignity, that we're going to go back to that. But most of the nation has bought this new deal, this Paul Ryan new deal, this Eric Cantor new deal, this John Boehner new deal, this Ronald Reagan, George Bush new deal. That working people, even college-educated working people, really only have the right in America to a job. Not a good job, not a middle-class job, just a job. This was the objection everybody was making back during the Clinton years. But lots of jobs were created. A lot of them were, do you want fries with that? And a lot of them ended up in China, you know, in subsequent years. Because while Bill Clinton did a lot of good as president, one of the things he didn't do was he didn't change that fundamental relationship. And neither has Barack Obama. In fact, Barack Obama hasn't even said out loud what I'm sharing with you. And he needs to. And Democrats across the board need to. Because basically the only people left who get this stuff are the Progressive Caucus and the House of Representatives, working people who actually have a union and know exactly what I'm talking about, or have a union member in their family, people who have exposure to the lifestyles of the truly mind-bogglingly rich and famous in America. Or those people listening to this program. I would submit that you're not going to find a conservative talk show host in America who will disagree with me on this. The conservative talk show hosts will all tell you, you know, yeah, the social contract has changed. You're no longer entitled. Just because you got a job at GM or Ford or Chrysler or Delco, or I guess they're gone now. But whatever, just because you've got a job making washing machines, or you got a good job as a union electrician or plumber or roofer, that doesn't mean you have a right to a middle class, to be part of the middle class. That means you have a right to be the working poor. You got a job. Quit complaining. That's what the conservatives will tell you. And that's what's going to be, that's the code that you're going to hear in the Republican debate. All this talk about jobs is not going to be talking about good jobs. It's not going to be talking about jobs with benefits. It's not going to be talking about jobs that allow people to get into the middle class. It's going to be talking about jobs that allow people to be the working poor in America, because that's the conservative plan for America, is to take this horrible middle class, horrible from their point of view, because it's the activist middle class. It's the pesky middle class. It's the middle class that demands environmental protection. It's the middle class that demands good schools. It's the middle class that makes it really, really hard for billionaires to become ultra-billionaires. To take that pesky middle class and turn it into the class of the working poor. And they're only a third of the way there.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I know a lot of you have been on the phone for a long, long time waiting for me to finish this rant. I'll pick up your calls right after this. Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Because I got high alert. Alcoholic elk. Yep, a Swedish man returned home late last night and came across a most unusual sight. An elk stuck in an apple tree. That's right, a full-grown elk. You know, they're like reindeer. Completely off the ground, tangled up in a tree. Turns out drunken elk are common in Sweden during the autumn when the apples begin to fall to the ground and begin to ferment. The elks enjoy the tasty alcoholic treats. After he was freed, the elk laid on the ground for a few hours to recover from his bender and then clumsily scampered off back into the woods, probably nursing a hangover. In a related story, Speaker of the House John Boehner denies he has recently been stuck in any trees.
And at Christmas time, you know, keep an eye out for those reindeers in the trees. Now you know. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Eva in San Francisco. Hey, Eva, what's up?
Oh, hi, Mr. Hartman. This is Eva Hart calling. This piece should be easy for you since you've been to the dentist. What I want to ask you,
I was agreeing.
Right. All right. Yes. I want to ask you a question about the lowering of the standing of living and how it happens after I mentioned this article. And you've spoken about this so many times. Should be easy for you. And Dr. Elliot Lebeau's 93 book, he's a socioeconomist, and he supports your contention about the lowering of the standing of living of the American middle class. And he's an anthropologist. He writes in his 93 book, he says, homelessness is the result of the lowering of the standing of living. And failures at the wage labor.
Eva, we have a policy on the program of not asking people not to read. If you could just summarize this in your own words, I would appreciate it.
I'm not reading it, Mr. Hartman.
Okay.
Lowering the standard living of the American working class and lower class, where the road to jobs is strewn with obstacles, and low status, low paying, hard boy jobs are undermining the work ethic, leading nowhere.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you the question, how does it happen? What are the intricacies of the failures of the American middle class and lowering of standard of living?
Okay. Thank you, Eva. I think that the failure of the American middle class has been to realize the class warfare has been fought against them to the extent that there is a failure of the American middle class. And it's been a failure to participate in politics. But there has been a serious effort, a multi-billion-dollar effort to snooker these people, and it's working. Carlana in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Carlana, what's up?
Well, I have a suggestion. I think all of us should be wearing great big pins or signs on our back that says, Google to Santa Claus theory.
Okay.
How you like that?
I like it. I've been the lone voice in the wilderness on this thing for two decades. I mean, it's like nobody, you know, Republican senior strategists know all about it. Republican politicians know all about it, but they're not talking.
Well, I was telling my granddaughter last night, I was saying I was going to have these talk to some people about making the big pins that you can wear or a sign that you can wear. And she said, well, she was taking paralegal studies, and she said that Google might object to saying Google such and such. So I said, well, there's a Google office here in town. Maybe I'll call and their legal department and clear it with them. But even if you didn't say Google, you could say search or whatever.
Sure.
Anyway, that's the biggest idea, which everybody who's listening can make their own little sign and put on their on their clothes, and just Google to Santa Claus theory. And I tested it. You can either write two, T-W-O, or you can write the number two.
Oh, and it pops up. So, it's starting to pop up now. I know that there was somebody actually put together a Wikipedia entry on it, but it, you know, of course, the Wikipedia entries are all thoroughly vetted by the Heritage Foundation, so they're not quite as very often. They're not quite.
Maybe there's some way of specifying, you know, the article that you had written about it. But
if you Google "to Santa Claus theory" and Tom Hartman, you will find the article that I wrote about it back, you know, half a decade ago that lays it out, complete with, you know, links and citations and things.
Right. Well, I was just trying to get the least number of words on a pin, as, you know, you have to go with the least number of words. But the reason why I called originally was back in 1979, I was a consultant to the U.S. Department of Energy on energy emergency preparedness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, one of those things where you think about it, you don't get around to doing, but really the Postal Service could be trained as emergency management responders in a whole lot of ways, which, for example, if for whatever reason we lost our electricity for some extended period of time, the Postal Service could be a huge benefit in communications and even delivery of goods to people if they weren't able to. Most people's telephones won't work if you turn off their electricity.
Mm.
And, of course, your computers are gone. So that would be one thing that I think the Postal Service could be trained and have as a responsibility. And then natural disasters and pandemics in particular, if you had the Postal Service that was already trained and set up to respond, again, it could be delivering medications and in some cases telling people what to do, you know, with the dead bodies until somebody can get to them, because a real pandemic sometimes involves having to bury granny in the backyard. And I'm a granny, so I figure I'm the one that will get buried in the backyard. But people know how to do these things. Anyway, there's a whole list of things which, you know, if with the Postal Service under such threat, that if they had, in addition to delivering the mail, if they were also assigned...
If I may interrupt you, Carolina, and the reason why is because we only have 30 seconds until this is going to end. But here's why I don't think that'll work. The bottom line is the Post Office represents about 600,000 unionized employees. It represents one of the last bastions of the old New Deal, that if you show up and you work, put in your 40-hour week, that you can have that middle-class life and buy the home and put the kids through college. And the cons want to destroy that. And the only way that they can destroy that is by destroying the post office in such a way that they get to then, you know, bankrupt the post office, break the contracts, rehire people at Taco Bell wages. And, you know, this is the war on the middle class. That's what's really going on. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. In the previous hour, we had on the president of the union, Chuck Zlatkin, the legislative and political director of the New York, legislative and political director of the New York Area Metro Postal Union, APWU of the AFL-CIO, and a rather detailed conversation not only of how they're trying to deconstruct the post office in order to destroy 600,000 middle-class jobs, but then the whole, basically the entire previous hour was, you know, my laying out, and I want to come back to this in a few minutes. This core topic that nobody's talking about, that there has been a recalibration of the New Deal. The old New Deal was, if you did good, you got a high school diploma, you worked your butt off, you could, have a decent life, you could buy a house, you could retire, you could put your kids through school, you could have a pension, you could have health care. The new Deal, brought to you courtesy of 30 years of Reaganomics, and now being made explicit by people like Paul Ryan, is that if you enter the workforce, even with a college diploma, the college diploma simply carries with it the debt that produces a guarantee that you're the working poor. And if you just have a high school diploma, the pay is at the level of the working poor. So the new American dream is, guess what? You get to be the working poor. And in fact, one in three Americans who was born in a time when they were in the middle class is now in the working poor, one in three. We'll come back to that topic in a few minutes. Right now, Cliff Schechter is with us. He is the National Progressive PR Strategist with Libertas LLC, nationally syndicated columnist for Al Jazeera English, author of the book The Real McCain. His website, LibertasLLC.com. He is Twitter at Cliff Schechter, S-C-H-E-C-T-E-R. And Cliff, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much, Tom. I appreciate you having me.
You wrote a piece, and in fact, I saw, interestingly, Andrew Sullivan wrote something very similar, and saying something that I've been saying since, and I'm not claiming pride of authorship here, I think a lot of us have been saying, literally since the weeks after 9/11, of course, the anniversary will be this weekend, thus the topic, and thus the wall-to-wall coverage in the media. And that is that bin Laden laid out a very specific goal with 9/11, and that goal was to goad us into responding to the Islamic world in a hyper-reactive way and create a war between the West and Islam so that he could use as a recruiting tool for al-Qaeda and turn himself into a hero and to bleed dry this country. These are the things that bin Laden said he was going to do back in 1998 in the New York Times.
Right.
So the question, did Osama bin Laden win?
Sadly, in a lot of ways, he did, you know. And I wrote my piece from a very personal perspective because I grew up in New York City, and I was one of the unlucky ones. It was actually primary day in New York that day. And so I was working on a political campaign down in that area. I had been in the North Tower 16 hours beforehand, and you know, with my own eyes from not far away, saw the second plane hit. And so, you know, I tried to talk about how, you know, it was a tough transformation, you know, tough for me to go forward and others, but more horrifying even than what I witnessed that day was how my country was transformed. And really, you know, I think it's all kind of right there in front of you when you've got in the past week Dick Cheney, you know, traveling around, you know, talking about his memoir and literally bragging about torture, bragging about war crimes, bragging about warrantless wiretapping, which is a crime, you know, not sort of hiding his role in any, not only hiding, but bragging in any of the number of things that he was involved in. And to me, you know, as sad as that day was, and it was really very tough for me for a while after that to sort of think and talk about it, but in my name and your name and the rest of our names, what these guys, you know, did to our country, you know, again, Bin Laden, they fulfilled, I think they went beyond what his expectations could have been.
Yeah.
And that's terrible. You know,
you write about watching the second plane hit and how it replays in your memory in slow motion. I think for most Americans, even who weren't there like you were, television made sure that we have that same PTSD trauma. And it seemed that, I mean, when Tim McVeigh blew up the Oklahoma City Federal Building, he had read the Turner Diaries, you know, the novel that's kind of the Bible of the white power movement in the United States.
Right.
And in that novel, you know, the hero of the novel blows up a federal building in Oklahoma City, and the president of the United States clamps down by taking away all the guns from everybody and stripping everybody of civil rights and turning basically America into a police state, which causes all the good white Christians to rise up and start basically killing people in an orgy of killing, starting with African Americans and then going on to people who are Jewish and then, of course, any government employee. And in the end, you know, only the good white Protestant Christians are left standing and ruling the country. And that's what Tim McVeigh thought he was going to bring about. It's really not that different a vision than Osama bin Laden thought he would bring about, in as much as he would, Bill Clinton did not overreact to Tim McVeigh. He did not do what McVeigh wanted, and thus, you know, we were spared, you know, 8 years of insanity as a result of this. But George Bush did exactly what bin Laden wanted, if I'm reading this right.
No, I agree. You know, I think that's a terrific analysis, that comparison, because we often look and say the far Christian right, the Binionists, those that would attack America, there, you know, you've talked about this, they're as anti-American as Muslim terrorists. I mean, is Eric Rudolph more pro-American than Osama bin Laden? Of course he's not. We, you know, Osama bin Laden sadly was more successful in murdering Americans, but these guys, you know, hate this country, you know, all of them, and they have this dream of bringing it to its knees and, you know, getting, and a part of that always, of course, involves the government overreacting and violent overreach. And you're right. You know, the interesting thing is, even the limited measures that President Clinton tried to enforce after the attack in Oklahoma City, you may remember he wanted to have some more transparency in banking and be able to stop some of the money that's being shifted from these sort of shadow groups to Al-Qaeda. You may remember a guy by the name of Phil Graham blocked that back then because there was too much government intrusiveness. Meanwhile, when these guys were in power, of course, the only thing they don't take away from you is anybody, you know, no matter how much of a terrorist or a criminal can get their hands on the gun still. But every single other right that we had, you know, when it comes to you know, they're searching our property without a warrant, when it comes to obviously prisons without due process, Guantanamo and the rest. I mean, again, I think the point I try to make in the piece is if anybody imagined this country in the late 90s or early or even the dawn of 2000, I just don't think we could have imagined that this would occur in our country. I couldn't imagine even someone in a position like Eric Cantor could stand there and say, we need to find budget offsets to help people that whose lives are just destroyed by a hurricane. And I feel like that's all kind of, you know, there's this sort of post 9/11, you know, we were manipulated. People used this to polarize us and to spur hatred between different groups. And I think a lot of what these guys, what the bin Ladens wanted, they got from the Dick Cheneys, and that's only made this country a sort of harder place at times. I don't want to say there still aren't some terrific people, and I love this country, and that's why I care. And there's some great people out there, but you know, it's been a darker place since then. You know, as you could guess by some of the things that we've heard and seen recently.
And it seems like Dick Cheney was probably one of the loudest leaders of the Be Afraid, Be Very Afraid movement within the government.
I mean, that seems exactly right. Look, if everything his memoir seems to say is true, it really seems like, as we would guess, as Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson said, you know, Colin Powell's chief of staff, that really in the end Dick Cheney was the president and Bush wasn't. We know that day that Cheney was the one who was saying it was okay to shoot down airplanes. I don't know where Bush was. And if that's the kind of level of control Cheney had, of course, I think you could probably blame him for a lot more. I mean, you probably could. We have evidence you could. And he admits you can. And that's just we need to get back to the dream that was America before 9/11. That's what we need.
Right. Yeah. Let's, you know, bring back my country, please.
Yeah.
And step by step, I think we'll get there. I think we're awakening from this long national nightmare that Bush and Cheney brought us. Cliff Schechter, LibertasLLC.com. Thank you, Cliff.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Good work you're doing.
Thanks.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So how is the American dream of freedom falling apart at the same time the economic American dream is? Exposing the con and conservative, Tom Hartman here with you. Mitt Romney laid this stuff out yesterday, and you know, nobody's talking about the fact that he was talking in code. That Mitt Romney was just, it was just basically, he was talking in code. I don't know how else to say it. He says, I will eliminate any tax on your savings if you're in the middle class. No tax on interest, dividends, or capital gains. Now, he didn't say if you're exclusively in the middle class, so, you know, it's obvious he intends to do this for his class. His, you know, he's worth a couple hundred million dollars, and for the class above him, the billionaires as well. No tax on interest, dividends, and capital gains, so if you make your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, if you make your living as an investor on Wall Street, or a speculator, or a gambler on Wall Street, your tax drops from 15% where it is now to zero under Romney. And this was an applause line from middle class people. Because he said, I will eliminate any tax on your savings if you're in the middle class. Well, those aren't the people who are being taxed on their savings. Those are not the people who are being taxed on capital gains. 90% of capital gains taxes are paid by the top 1% of Americans. He said, back in the 50s and 60s, every business in the world wanted to be located here. This was the place business was done. This was the largest market in the world. Nothing else compared to the market of the United States. And so government could charge business whatever the heck they wanted in taxes, because where else was the business going to go? This is where they were. This is where their capital was, their capital plant, their blast furnaces, transfer lines, assembly lines. All of them were here in the United States. Today they are outside the United States. They're growing fast. Now, why might that be? According to Mitt Romney, I mean, he's living in this Tom Friedman world is flat world. According to Mitt Romney, it's just because it magically happened. I mean, in the 60s and 70s and 80s, in 1960, there were 3 billion people on the planet. We had a population of a little over 200 billion in the United States. We had plenty of competitors outside the United States, humans who were willing to work for less, lots and lots of cheap labor, lots and lots of countries with no environmental standards, so, you know, no onerous regulations that you couldn't poison people. So why didn't our companies move back then? Well, because back then we had a trade policy that prevented, that it didn't prevent companies from moving overseas. It just made it very expensive for them. So they didn't. They stayed here. But Mitt Romney says, no. He wants to, what's his solution? He said, we've got to bring down our corporate tax rate. In fact, you know, when he talks about how America used to be, he said, now to John and a few of the other older folks in the audience like myself, it sounds a bit like the 1950s and 60s and 70s. And you might say, can't we just go back to the way things were back then? Well, a lot's changed in our global economy over the last few decades. Why, 30 years ago, China represented 1% of the economic conditions of the world. 1%. Now they're 10 times that amount. And 30 years ago, America was overwhelmingly the largest manufacturing nation in the world. This year, China is slated to pass us as the largest manufacturing nation in the world. About 30 years ago, at the Nobel Prize Awards, Americans were affiliated, or people affiliated with American institutions, won three-quarters of the Nobel Prizes. Today, it's less than half that amount. The world has changed. Mitt Romney, yesterday, his job speech, he said, "This is an entirely different economy than the kind of economy we knew in the 50s and 60s. And so our economic strategy has to be brought up to date to make sure we're able to provide the vision that I described." By brought up to date, what he means is that this whole idea of, you know, you work hard and you join the middle class is obsolete. What he means is that, you know, Medicare should be turned into a voucher system, that our schools should be privatized for profit, that our healthcare system should be, you know, totally for profit. It's largely for profit now anyway, which is why it's one of the most, it is the most expensive in the world, producing some of the worst outcomes in the developed world. This is Mitt Romney's vision. I've seen it played out in companies that he's taken over, where I, you know, I saw people who worked in these companies and who were making a good middle class wage get fired or laid off so that they could be replaced by somebody who would literally work for a third of what they were making. Because the new social contract, the new social compact, the new vision of America that started with Ronald Reagan, with Reaganomics, and is still being played out, that vision of American economics is that you're not entitled to a middle-class job anymore. You're entitled to a working poor job. You're not entitled to a job that, to you know, where one person can work 40 hours a week, even though our productivity has gone up in a way that would allow that. Our wages have been stagnant since Ronald Reagan was elected president, even though productivity has gone up. Where's all that money gone? It's gone to millionaires and billionaires and large corporations. Because now, instead of being entitled to decent pay for decent work, we are entitled to crummy pay for decent work. I mean, that's the new America. And there's just something fundamentally destructive about that, because it doesn't allow us to build a middle class. It tracks back to our trade policies, it tracks back to our taxation policies. It has everything to do with how it's done by government. I'm telling you, this election in 2012 is going to be a really, really, really important election.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, your calls and a conservative alert. Use both hands. I'll explain.
I'm gonna get up off my butt and give me a job. I'm picking, picking all day, picking around all night. I'm looking for a place to rock.
I mean, these are the stories I've been talking about here. Welcome back, by the way, 34 minutes past the hour in the chat room. Dorian says they're trying to replace the New Deal with the Raw Deal, Tom. Absolutely right. Brett Iso, let's see here. Oh, it was Crystal Lynn. I'm sorry. I work volunteer with a food bank here in Seattle. 25% increase in clientele. Crystal. My brother has a master's in education. He works with a pest control company. He's happy to have the job. I know a woman with a PhD working as a cashier in a health food store. Also know an economics master's degree working as in the register at Barnes & Noble. I can tell you personally, when I moved here here to Washington, D.C., and we started doing the television program for Free Speech TV and RT, I had to pick up some clothes for TV. Went into Macy's. The guy who was helping me out was a lawyer. And he's selling clothes at Macy's because he couldn't find a job as a lawyer. Very nice guy. Very smart guy. It's like, it's just, I mean, this is how, this is, you are entitled to poverty level wages, and that's it. By the way, freespeech.org, this, you know, our show is syndicated by a variety of syndicators, Pacifica, Dial Global, commercial stations, non-commercial stations, and on television. We are simulcast right now as a TV show on both national satellite networks that cover all of North America, Dish Network and DirecTV. And there are a couple hundred cable systems around the country that have picked up our show as well as television, sort of like the old Don Imus show. I mean, you can actually watch this. But Free Speech TV is trying to expand this into the major cable carriers, Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, et cetera. And they need your help. Over at freespeech.org, and this isn't just my show. This is for the entire network. This is an alternative to Fox Network, basically. A 24-7 progressive network. A real 24-7 progressive network. freespeech.org, they've launched a public petition to get a campaign to get Free Speech TV and my shows, both radio and TV show, on the major cable carriers. We need 50,000 signatures over the next 2 weeks. So I'm asking you right now to go over to freespeech.org and sign up. We need your help on this, so check it out, freespeech.org, and sign the petition. Oh, it's our conservative alert for the day. Rick Perry had this to say.
Mr. Governor, are you for gun control? or do you oppose?
I'm actually for gun control. Use both hands.
Guy's got good timing. I mean, he's got very good timing. He's a very, very competent politician. Do not underestimate Rick Perry. And I have a feeling, oh, we'll see tonight. See tonight how it's all going to play out. Dan in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Love your show and appreciate the work you're doing.
Thank you.
I want to make a comment about, first of all, I'm a team leader in my county for Organizing for America, and was at the speech that President Obama gave on Labor Day, and I have some renewed confidence in the man and his message, and we need more volunteers, so, you know, that's the first thing. Mm-hmm. Second is a comment about the rich, the millionaires and billionaires, and how the middle class relates to them. I know that, and I have a master's degree, an MBA, a bachelor's degree in business, and I understand that those people think that the middle class sort of are their enemy. But what I think they don't understand is that the economic structure in our country, Tom, is one that it's not conducive to having a huge poor class and a very small rich class. If they keep it up and they're on the route they're on, they're not going to have any customers anymore for their businesses and their enterprises. And I just, you know, I wonder when they're going to kind of wise up to that.
Well, I think they're already there, and that's why you see General Electric doing 54% of its business outside the United States. It's why you see all these companies moving outside the United States. So they all want to establish, you know, retail outlets in China and in India. Walmart lobbied India very, very hard. India used to have a law that said that no family or company could own more than two retail stores in the country. That law was changed. Now you've got chains growing there. They're all going global. They're going, you know, they went global in their manufacturing. The U.S. is still the world's largest marketplace for consumer goods, but only because we've been running on credit. And you're right. At a certain point, we will no longer be that largest marketplace. And when that happens, they'll just go someplace else. That's because the laws have been reorganized in such a way to make it quite easy for them to. So they don't, frankly, give a rat's patootie.
Agree. Thanks for your answer, and thanks for the work you're doing. I love your show.
Thank you very much. I mean, this is the real tragedy of it, and it's the tragedy that people don't even realize that the idea of the American dream that was laid in stone in the 1930s with the New Deal and amplified with Lyndon Johnson's Great Society has been dismantled over the last 30 years from if you work hard, you're entitled to a middle-class lifestyle to now if you work hard, you're entitled to survival wages. You're entitled to be the working poor. Jeremy in Huntington Beach, California. Hey, Jeremy, what's up?
Tom, it occurs to me that the people shouting the loudest about socialism and the like Michelle Bachmann and Rick Perry and Bachmann, made most of their money on the public dole. And it seems to me it's kind of like the gay guy who, like, keeps talking about gay people and how much he hates them. Aren't they just projecting? I mean, and it seems to me like the propaganda, I mean, it's more emotionally charged if you study psychology if you're really projecting your own tendencies on everybody else. You know, it's more of an emotionally, you know, potent thing for you. So I'm wondering if the propaganda is purposely designed to, you know, repulse people towards the idea of what they call socialism because it's within the human, you know, constitution.
Right.
What they call socialism, not actual socialism. I'm talking about mutual support.
Sure.
Of each other, what the founders called, you know, self-evident truths, you know.
Right.
That we are designed to actually help each other. And, you know, be independent.
And provide for the general welfare. Yeah.
Yeah. It seems really clear to me. I think the propaganda is purposely designed to get people to project their own, you know, so-called socialist tendencies. And that's why they're able to manipulate these people so much. It's so emotional about it.
One of us,
you can't even reason with them.
You know, Russell Kirk was the grand old man and great thinker of the modern-day conservative movement. He wrote a book called The Conservative Mind back in 1953 that is... even today, considered the Bible of the conservative movement. Barry Goldwater cited it constantly, William F. Buckley, you know, right up to today's, you know, conservative thinkers and speakers. And Kirk laid out 10 tenets of conservative thought, you know, who conservatives are, what makes somebody conservative. And one of them was, he said, conservatives realize that people are, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't have the quote directly in front of me, but it is pretty close to word for word. Conservatives realize that that people are more driven and motivated by emotion than by logic. And so we get these emotional pitches to us. For example, the new one that is coming out that is part of the let's dismantle the middle class is, look at those government workers over there. They get to work 30 years and then retire with a pension and health care until the day they die, and you don't. You know, you work at Taco Bell or you know, wherever you happen to work, and you got nothing. You know, you got no savings. Well, maybe a little 401k or something. But, you know, look at those people. We how dare those people? We need to take it away from those people. When, in fact, you know, and this is that greed, envy, you know, kind of thing. When, in fact, what we should be saying is, you know, everybody should have the right to a decent wage and to, you know, full benefits. And health, at the very least, health insurance, and ideally a pension of some kind. If, you know, particularly if they're in some kind of a job where they're, you know, it's like a manufacturing job where the factory expects to be around for a while. It's just, I find it nuts. I, you know, as to the psychology of it, there's a bunch of different ways to spin that, but I think the practical, and thank you, Jeremy, for calling and pointing it out. I think the practical reality of it was that back in the 60s, the conservatives looked at the ferment of the 60s, the women's movement, Martin Luther King saying, I have a dream, which literally was African Americans saying, we want that same American dream that white folks have had for the last 20 years. That middle class dream. That gays were speaking out. Right across the board, you had people saying, we want to be part of the mainstream of America. And the conservatives said, holy cow, we can't have this. This middle class thing, this is dangerous. And they set about taking it apart, aggressively set about taking it apart. Jim in Seattle. Hey, Jim, we got a minute. What's up?
Hey, hi. Just a quick kind of comment. You know, we're talking, you hear the Republicans, Michelle Bachmann, they're all bashing about lowering the tax rate for corporations. And I'm just wondering, well, okay, that's fine. Let's just do that. When you realize that Boeing's, all these other big, huge corporations don't pay a single cent in taxes, let's lower the rate, but let's take off every single exemption they have, every single perk, and make them pay a flat tax straight across the board off what they're actually making.
Yeah, I don't think it should be flat. I think it should be progressive. Having run a bunch of corporations, there are times when, you know, you're just squeaking by, and there are times when you're doing really well. And when you're doing really well, that should be when you're paying back. But I don't disagree with you. I think it is not unreasonable to lower the tax rate on corporations in America from 35% to 25% and massively close the loopholes and massively simplify the corporate tax code. In fact, I think it's a very good idea. It would increase revenue. Thank you, Jim.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And I was listening very carefully to Mitt Romney yesterday, and he was saying, we're going to drop the tax rate to 25%. He never mentioned closing the loopholes. Huh.
Job creator, won't you? Job creator, won't you? Job creator, you contributed enough. So go buy more good stuff like boats and cars. And don't mind people calling you rich if that's what you are.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, job creators, right. Oh, my. By the way, get over to freespeech.org and sign that petition. And, oh, you might want to hang on a little bit. I just heard that we've had so many people try to get onto freespeech.org that we've crashed their website. So make a note, put it on a post-it, stick it on your refrigerator, and later in the day when their website comes, this happens so often. We mention a website, and then people call up and go, you just crashed my website. You know, 20,000 people hit my website all at once. Anyway. Freespeech.org, sign the petition. Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service. Here's another website that you might want to check out, goatsfortheoldgoat.com.
That's right. And some of your people have been giving us goats. You can give a partial goat, you know.
Yes.
And it really does help hunger in South Sudan and also our post-traumatic stress project with women, many of whom meet every other day, who have seen at least one person killed in front of them. And also we give a goat to returning slaves.
Yeah, and this isn't just here's a meal. This is literally change your life because the goat stays with them for years.
A child has goat's milk, and I know that there are some people that believe we ought not to gain milk from animals or anything, but if a child has goat's milk, there's really makes the difference between malnutrition and not malnutrition.
Yeah,
so goats for the old goat.
We're talking one of the poorest parts of the world, Southern Sudan.
.com, .org, they all lead to the same place.
There you go. Ellen Ratner, what's going on in the world?
Okay, well, an unusual event today. Harry Reid got on the floor of the Senate and actually made a speech. Now, that doesn't happen very often. It does happen. But he said that Republicans, he was very direct, are blocking job creation measures. And he said that he's hoping the Republicans are willing to reach across the aisle. He said they've wasted time on partisan politics. They've blocked reauthorization of the Economic Development Administration. They've held up efforts to pass long-term reauthorization of the Small Business Innovation and Research Program. And then he said they killed the bill altogether. He said that alone just cost thousands of jobs. And he said also it was important to extend the authorization of the FAA bill. As you know, they passed a temporary one.
Right.
And he said that would protect alone 280,000 jobs. And he also said that if they authorized federal spending for the nation's highways and also for transit projects, 1.8 million jobs.
So although I'm sure he didn't say it this way, basically Harry Reid pointed out that the Republicans are doing everything they can to drive up unemployment as we head into the 2012
election. Right, and of course, they know that if they put up unemployment, then of course it makes the president much more vulnerable.
Yes, and they're doing it.
The president is actually going to follow up his speech by going to the University of Richmond, Virginia on Friday to follow up on that. Some interesting things, because, of course, we know that they're going to try and put infrastructure project. There was an Energy Department project, and I know it was given in block grants to the states. A lot of people I knew in Massachusetts who were older benefited from this. This is ways to refurbish your house so that it's much more energy efficient. Also helps older people a lot and people who are low income. But they did not spend $897 million of the $2.7 million. That was by the department's own inspector general who found that out. Energy department said, well, we're a little slow on it, but the energy department said, well, we created 5,400 jobs in the process. There is a Republican debate tonight.
Yes,
just in case you haven't been talking about it, I'm sure you
no,
are.
There's quite a scandal over at Fox News. Not enough podiums.
Oh yes, well, okay.
Yes.
NBC
is sponsoring it.
If Perry participates, and it looks as if he is going to be there tonight, Bachman and Romney are expected to go on the attack. You know, but what the press is doing is they're totally X-ing out. They're saying it's a two-horse race now, that Ron Paul is a long-shot candidate, He came in third in the straw poll. Mm-hmm. I mean, he did pretty well in New Hampshire last time around, expected to do pretty well this time. Why are we already deciding?
He came in second in the straw poll,
yeah,
actually.
Well, he was the second, right.
And they never mentioned it.
Right.
It's like Fox News. I watched for an entire hour, I watched Fox News after that came out, and they never mentioned his name.
It's just really quite amazing. So anyway, so that is happening tonight at the Reagan Library. Yeah. Now, what's also going to happen tonight at the Reagan Library is that Ron Paul is going to do an anti-Perry ad, and it's going to air twice during the primary, actually. Very, very clever of Ron Paul,
wow.
Speaking of Ron Paul.
You mean he bought National Network time?
He bought National Network time. There's 60 seconds spots, and they also highlight how Perry had supported Al Gore in the 1988 presidential election.
Now, there are those who say that Ron Paul's got his own skeleton, political skeleton in the closet, in as much as in 1988, he left the Republican Party to run for president of the United States under the Libertarian platform,
right.
and said that Ronald Reagan had been a traitor to the conservative cause. And that's a phrase that doesn't go well with Republicans.
No, it doesn't go well. But, you know, again, Ron Paul has managed to survive a lot of people looking at some of his past records.
Yeah.
And they don't seem to care.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
his true believers are true believers.
And speaking of, I mean, this Perry stuff, it just gets too good not to go on. But Karl Rove was on television this morning. He was on ABC Good Morning. And he talks about Perry's book, Fed Up, which came out last year. Most of us didn't pay much attention to it. But he said that his views, Perry apparently had these views about Social Security, and he called Social Security toxic. Rove called Perry's views toxic because Perry essentially said that this was a giant giveaway and it was big government, et cetera, et cetera. And so Rove this morning called it toxic. So I guess Rove has not been hired by the Perry campaign.
Apparently not. And I understand his book is out of print now, too.
Right. Well,
it's like, no, you can't buy that.
You know, it's apologies to anybody who happens to be Christian Scientist listening to this, but you cannot find actually any original copies of Science and Health anywhere in the world because apparently it was originally annotated where some of the original sources were. There's a big scandal about that, and so you will only find
Quimby.
Second. Yes, that's
yeah,
exactly
Mary,
that's
Mary Baker Eddy basically ripped it off from Quimby. And I
the Quimby paper, exactly.
Yeah, I've seen the original Quimby stuff.
Right, yeah. So, and you cannot find a copy of Science and Health anywhere.
That's amazing.
So that's on that front. Also, this came out yesterday, late afternoon, but Senator Lieberman said that the White House was going to aid in the U.S. postal crisis.
Oh, that's remarkable. Let's hope that it happens.
Yes, it needs to happen.
Seriously hope that it happens. Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service, thank you so much. Up next, Republican Congressman Ernest Istook. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour. We've had a variety of wide-ranging conversations today, from what's going on with the Postal Service to what's going on with the middle class. I think that that's the key to what's going on in the Republican field, with the Republican Party, and where they're going and how they're going and how it's all happening. And on the line with me right now is former Congressman Ernest Istook. Am I pronouncing that correctly, sir?
Istook, just like the two words put together.
Istook. Yeah, there you go. Distinguished fellow in government studies at the Heritage Foundation, former congressman from Oklahoma's 5th District, heritage.org. Of course, the Heritage Foundation site, and istook.com is your website. Distinguished fellow, working on the Jolly Good Fellow?
That's the goal.
Okay, good on you. Also, Twitter at Ernest_Istook and at Heritage, of course. Mitt Romney yesterday laid out a jobs plan in his speech. I watched the speech. In fact, I have a transcript of it here. And it seemed to me like he was basically saying he was going to do the exact same thing that George W. Bush did, drop taxes, cut regulations. And how did that create any jobs? I'm missing something here.
Well, if you go back to the lowering things like capital gains tax rates during the Bush administration, it most definitely did create jobs. I mean, I recommend to people, if you want to see something fascinating, find the speech that John F. Kennedy made as president when he was sponsoring lowering of tax rates and extolled the philosophy of how that does indeed help the economy. So, yes, I know that some people want to have a mythology saying that lowering taxes does not stimulate the economy, but I can tell you I do not subscribe to that myth.
So during
when people have incentives to do more, they produce more.
So during the period from the 1930s until the 1980s, early 80s, when the top tax rates were 74 to 91%, people were not keeping their money in their businesses. They were not starting businesses. They were not growing. I mean, that was the time. Those 3 decades were the only time we ever had consistent decade to decade GDP growth over over 3%. Was when we had a top tax rate.
The tax code was filled with loopholes so that it was a fiction, the notion that most people were paying that rate, because it was filled with so many loopholes with giving people ways to evade that. And it's better to have fewer loopholes and lower tax rates because, you know, some people talk only in terms of they equate tax increases with revenue increases. And that doesn't necessarily follow. They're not the same thing.
You're absolutely right. And in fact,
you take a smaller percent of the pie, you can bake a bigger pie.
Yeah. And since you mentioned John Kennedy and his position on this, I think, you know, he ended this with a plea of, I want to be on the record for this. He starts out, this is the speech that you're talking about. And it's from the Nixon Kennedy debates. And
I'm talking about a national broadcast he made as president, not during the debates.
Okay, well, they were essentially the same thing. This was the same thing. And he said he wants to make tax changes that would actually generate more revenue, not through some kind of supply-side magic, but by closing loopholes, and that he would use that extra money to spend it. Here's what he had to say. This is Jack Kennedy.
Yes, I have stated in both the debates and state again that I believe in a balanced budget and have supported that concept during my 14 years in the Congress. The only two times when an unbalanced budget is warranted would be during a serious recession, and we had that in 58 in an unbalanced budget of $12 billion, or a national emergency where there should be large expenditures for national defense, which we had in World War II and during part of the Korean War.
Okay, so then he says he wants his tax changes, which is really where we should have started this clip.
Yeah, and I'm talking about the speech that he gave in November. As president.
Yeah, that was the setup. I shouldn't have wasted your time with that part of it. But here's where he continues, if I may. This is just a few minutes.
It's possible to gain a $700 million to $1 billion through tax changes, which I believe would close up loopholes on dividend withholding, on expense accounts.
And then he talks about how he's going to use that.
So in my judgment, we would spend more money in this administration on aid to education. We'd spend more money on housing. We'd spend more money, and I hope more wisely, on defense than this administration has done. But I believe that the next administration should work for a balanced budget, and that would be my intention. Mr. Nixon misstates my figures constantly, which is, of course, his right. But the fact of the matter is, here is where I stand. And I just want to have it on the public record.
And people are still misstating it when he actually didn't live to see that happen. It was Nixon who did it, as you know, or LBJ who did it, as you know, in 64.
I don't have it with me, and I don't have the ability to play it for you. But I'm talking about the speech he gave as president in November of 1961, where he called for boosting the economy explicitly by lowering the tax rates, and how that would help more people be employed because there would be more incentives for businesses to plow money back into their businesses rather than hand the money over to Uncle Sam.
It's very interesting. Back in the 70s, I was running a business in Michigan, and we were doing very well. Thank you very much. Louise and I have had several over the years, and I hit a point where my CPA sat down with me and he said, you know, your tax rate right now, your income tax rate is running over 40%. You really will probably in the long run make more money if instead of taking this out as pay, you keep it in the business, because I owned a little over 50% of the stock in the company. So if you keep it in the business and, you know, put it into advertising, marketing, grow the business. And we did. We went from, at that time, 14 employees to 18 employees and grew the business. And had the taxes been lowered, I would have taken that money out and put it in the stock market or put it in a Swiss bank account. I don't see why taxes, I mean, you know, from my own personal experience, when tax rates were high, I kept money in my business. And when tax rates were low, you know, I sold a business because the tax rates were capital gains rates were dropping. I mean, I don't see how that helps the economy. I don't get it.
Well, yeah, to say that higher rates encourage businesses to hire more people, you know, I understand your example there. But right now, when businessmen, small businessmen in particular, are told that the more you earn, if you plow it back in business in a down economy, you don't necessarily reap the benefit. Now, I realize that you could lift a lot of things if you gave people some proper signals where you change the entire attitude of people toward this. But when President Obama is consistently defending higher regulations, with the exception of the announcement he made last Friday, when he's consistently defending those, when he's consistently saying, well, if I can't raise taxes now, I will plan on raising them in January of 2013. When, you know, you have all these different sledgehammers, one after the other, coming out of the federal government, you look at the passage of Obamacare and the huge uncertainty that it created, all the businesses that say that is creating so much uncertainty that I don't feel that I can expand, as well as the additional cost.
You know, every business that I've...
studies that are out there on it. Howard Fineman last weekend was saying the biggest mistake that Obama made was pushing through Obamacare. That's Howard Fineman, for goodness sakes.
Every business that I've ever started was based on total uncertainty. I don't know any entrepreneur who hasn't. When you go into business, it is uncertain. Uncertainty isn't what business people want. What people want are customers. They want people to have money in their pockets to buy their goods.
And again, but if the folks that are running the show in Washington, of the president in particular, it's not just uncertainty. I mean, I realize there's a risk factor in business. You're exactly right about that, Tom. But this type of uncertainty is somebody standing behind you with a sledgehammer telling you they are going to whack you.
Well, you're gonna whack you how?
Just uncertainty.
You're talking about like when Bill Clinton raised income tax rates by 3%?
Believe me, President Obama is not only talking about the tax rates. We've had, within his tenure already, we've had $40 billion a year in regulatory increases with 75 major regulations passed.
And I would argue that those actually...
Obama's releasing a list of seven... multi-billion-dollar regulations.
Okay, we're out of time. I'll leave you the last word. Ernest Istook, Heritage.org. Thank you, sir.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Good talking with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what is the new normal for our economy? What is the new normal for the middle class? Is there to be a middle class in the future? Or is it all about uncertainty? Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. Jason in Washington, D.C., listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Jason, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Hey, I just wanted to point out the fact that, you know, every time you go in and you purchase an item in the store, you're voting. So a number of years ago, what happened?
Sort of.
Well, here, like, look at the milk thing, you know, the milk that had that PHB stuff in it that everybody was worried about. Nobody started buying it because they figured out it was bad for them. Right. And now all the milk producers aren't using it anymore. But the thing I was going to say is that, look, for all these people that are out there and they're all worried about stuff, I haven't seen a single person on, like, the Apple board of directors say, we're going to pay the people in Japan, in China a living wage and have really stringent environmental standards.
Right.
You know, I mean, they got a place over there, 250,000 people are manufacturing iPod products, and it's so bad that they've got to have, like, counseling for people to stop committing suicide.
Yeah, that's Foxconn is actually that company that the Apple contracts with. And there was a study that was...
They demand that on their board of directors.
I don't disagree, but the board of directors' mandate is to increase the profitability of the company, to increase shareholder value. And if manufacturing in China is legal and doing, you know, or anywhere else in the world is legal and it increases shareholder value, they would be violating their own essentially oath of office by arguing for anything else. I mean, this is why I say it's not evil Apple, it's not evil China for that matter, it's not evil Walmart, it's our laws that have been drilled into by lobbyists. I mean, if you want an evil group, there's the lobbyists, but it's our laws that have been drilled into and changed to the point where, I mean, that Ross Perot was right. You know, that giant sucking sound. And only it's not just from the South. It's from all over the world because we've dropped all our barriers and other countries are maintaining theirs. And by the way, the recombinant bovine growth hormone is still being used on cattle. It's just that, you know, the government made it illegal to label saying that you don't have it because that would scare people into thinking, oh, I shouldn't have this. There's a long and twisted story there with a very interesting history. But I get your point, Jason, that as consumers, we may be able to in some ways influence companies. But the fact of the matter is typically we don't. You know, we need to be influencing our legislators, not our corporate boards, because the corporate boards are going to do it's like saying, you know, we want to change the game of baseball. We think that the three-strike rule is silly and we want to go to a four-strike rule. Well, you don't just, you know, start lobbying individual baseball players or owners of teams. Actually, I don't even know how you do it with baseball. But the point is you change the rules of the game. And the rules of the game are made by our legislature, and that's where we need to be doing it. John in Montrose, Colorado. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom, you got the greatest show.
Thank you. What's up?
My comment was that, I think my history is correct on this, but wasn't it Henry Ford that said, I want to pay my workers a considerable amount, you know, $5 a day or whatever it was a lot of money.
That's what it was,
a lot of money in those days, so that they would be able to buy a vehicle, one of the vehicles that they're producing at this plant. Consequently, that was one of the reasons why he was able to sell so many vehicles.
Yeah, there's a little more to the story than that, which is actually an interesting backstory. His business partner was a progressive who later ended up either the senator from or the governor of Michigan. He later got into politics. I'm sorry, I can't remember his name. And his wife was very progressive. And they basically ganged up on Henry Ford. The prevailing wage at that time was $1 a day. And told him, start paying $5 a day. And, you know, it'll be a good thing for the country. It'll be good. You'll set a good example. This guy wanted to use this as part of his political launching pad, et cetera. So Henry Ford, over his own best judgment, did it. When he then started paying his workers $5 a day, good stuff did happen, except that Horace Dodge, who owned the Dodge Motor Company, sued him. And it went to the Supreme Court in the state of Michigan. And in the Supreme Court, you know, the argument was made that Henry Ford should not be allowed to pay people $5 an hour because it would, you know, it decreased shareholder value in the Ford Motor Company, and that had to be his first mandate. And Ford's lawyer's defense was that by paying his workers $5 a day, he was enabling them to buy his own products. He was helping create a market for his own products, and thus he won the case in the Michigan Supreme Court, although that case is often cited as precedent for the notion that a board of directors has to make decisions, even if they seem philanthropic, that ultimately inure to the benefit of the stockholders.
That just seems insane to me that, you know, to try to help your own workers and consequently help your own company,
yeah,
that some other company could sue you and say, nah, you're doing a better job with your company. It doesn't seem right.
Yeah, it's a very strange and odd history. It also had to do with Henry Ford's desire not to have strikes and dealing with the labor movement at that time. It was fairly complex. But the bottom line, you're absolutely right. Henry Ford was paying five times what his competitors were paying, and it worked out very well for him. Thanks a lot, John, for the call. Michael in Tempe, Arizona. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Thanks for being on here. I basically just want to piggyback off of a lot of things that you've been saying. I've listened to your show for a long time, and I'm a big fan. And it's funny because my wife and I had a similar conversation this morning. We were talking about Obama's speech coming up, and we were talking about the 2012 election. And basically, I mean, this is the first election I don't think I'm going to vote in. I'm in Tempe, Arizona, and I just...
In other words, you're going to vote for the Republican.
Yeah, I know. That sucks, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
I mean, it does, because this is the thing, is that, I mean, I just feel that, you know, the middle class in this country has lost. I mean, we're going to win a few battles here and there,
yeah,
but I just think we've lost.
If
everything you said today kind of kind of feels that way.
If just, the I mean, yeah, we have, and we have lost because people like you didn't show up to vote. And you know, Michael, if you're genuinely saying this, if you're not you know some shill for the Republican Party who's calling up saying these kind of things, because that that's one of their main memes is get Democrats not to vote. But you know, if you're genuinely saying this, then I got to tell you, you're the problem. And you know, in my opinion, you have no right to complain about how things are if you're not doing something about it. And not showing up to vote is the ultimate not doing something about it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the very, 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 very ugly. And your calls. Yep, that would be the good, the bad, and the very, very erroneously ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good! California Senator Barbara Boxer, reacting to President Obama's decision last week to delay new regulations curbing pollution until 2013, Boxer encouraged environmental groups to sue the administration. She told reporters yesterday, "I disagree strongly with the administration's decision, and I hope they'll be sued in court, and I hope the court can stand by the Clean Air Act. Clean air isn't something we should be waiting around for, and it's time for the president to keep his campaign promise to heal the planet. And if it takes lawsuits, as Senator Boxer is suggesting, I'm all for it." The bad. Alabama Senator Richard Shelby. Shelby has been one of the most outspoken critics of the newly created Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that works to make sure that the middle class isn't screwed over by banksters like Goldman Sachs again. He even wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal back in July in which he called the new Consumer Protection Bureau dangerous. Well, as the Public Campaign Action Fund discovered this week, we now know why Senator Shelby wrote the op-ed, and most likely why he hates the consumer protections. Because he's been bought out by the banksters. One day after writing the op-ed, Shelby was handed a $5,000 campaign check from, you guessed it, Goldman Sachs. So how much money do unemployed Americans need to send Shelby for him to write an op-ed on their behalf? Probably more than they have. And the very, very ugly, Ann Coulter. As more and more people realize Coulter is just a hack trying to sell books and stop listening to her, she always has a home on the couch over at Fox & Friends. And that's where she was this morning, attacking public school teachers. Taking on James Hoffa's Labor Day rally speech, Coulter said, "This is Jimmy Hoffa." Actually, his name is James Hoffa. "President of the Teamsters. They used to be truck drivers and pipe fitters. Now he's representing public school teachers, kindergarten teachers. What a pathetic downgrade. Real jobs for real men as opposed to kindergarten teachers." Kindergarten teachers are pathetic. I guess Ann still has a bad memory from kindergarten. After all, she still has yet to learn the one important lesson from that grade. Play nice with others. And that's very, very ugly. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, Sam in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. Hey, Sam, what's on your mind, sir?
Hey, man, how's it going?
Good. What's up?
Hey, you know, I'm glad I'm a member of Free Speech TV, and I pay my dues every month. But I don't have no computer, and I can't sign that petition.
Okay, well, tell a friend, too. Anyhow, what's on your mind?
All about that Rick Perry running for president. He can't even take care of Texas.
Uh-huh.
That's another one of them arrogant Republicans from Texas. And
yeah.
I can't forget what LBJ said about, you know, God forbid if a Republican governor from Texas ever come president.
Yeah, well, he was a Republican senator or a Democratic senator from Texas. But, yeah, okay, good point. And do we really want another Republican governor of Texas President of the United States? I don't know. Ray in Dartmouth, Mass. Hey, Ray, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I just listened to CNBC at the top of the hour, and I heard something that was very interesting. One of the gentlemen on CNBC was saying that the Supreme Court of the United States is set to opine on Obamacare September of 2012.
Right.
So considering that they will probably be deliberating the entire year of 2012, whenever they start, but they're going to actually come down with a ruling in September. According to the CNBC guy, who's talking about what the next big political move would be that might move the market.
Right.
This, in its essence, is exactly what you've been saying for years and years, that it's all about the courts. This right-wing Supreme Court is set to have an October surprise, in this case a September surprise, September 2012, come down that Obamacare is unconstitutional and completely flatten the Obama administration.
Yeah, and this is why, you know, I would vote for just about anybody if they were not a Republican as president, because first of all, the power of the president for anything other than the bully pulpit is wildly overstated and misunderstood by the American people. And secondly, although George Bush made very, very effective use of the bully pulpit, he lied a lot to us, and he was quite successful, you know, getting us into wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and things like that. But beyond the bully pulpit, the major power that the president has is to appoint people to the Supreme Court. And that is a power that will change the nation for a generation at least, and in some cases two generations. And it is one of the reasons why the Republicans, the Koch brothers back in June in Colorado when they got together, we played the tape of it yesterday, saying, you know, who's going to pony up $1 million? We have the mother of all wars. This guy is Saddam Hussein. I mean, they're taking this very seriously because they know that right now they've got the court. And if President Obama is reelected, there's a very good chance they won't have the court 5, 6, 7 years from now.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. But this is, this caught me by surprise when I heard this on CNBC. And I just, you're the first person I thought of because you're always the one that's been right on top of the courts of what we have to watch.
Yeah.
Exactly how they're going to pull their little October surprise.
Yeah. This is the court that actually decided the presidential election in 2000. So the idea that they would influence the election of 2012 shouldn't surprise us. Ray, thanks a lot for the call. And I'd heard that story. I hadn't heard the date. I knew that they had granted cert to the case. It came from, as I recall, the First Circuit or the Fourth Circuit? In any case, I knew that they'd granted cert to the case, that they had decided that they were going to hear the case in 2012. I don't know, and I don't think anybody can say for sure when a decision will come down. It may well be in October. Who knows? Bernie in South Haven, Michigan. Hey, Bernie, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Good.
Just wanted to go back on a couple of things. In 1961, my uncle was Kennedy's Secretary of Labor, and he got the minimum wage raised for back then.
Good on him.
Also, what?
I said good on him. That's.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's done an awful lot. In 1948, he was able to get the health and welfare for the United Steelworkers.
What was his name?
For the Goldberg, Arthur J.
Oh, yeah, Arthur Goldberg.
Yes. Yeah. And what's going on, my view, is that we're letting a lot of the stuff that the Republicans are doing slide. They're not really talking about, like with the Koch brothers in Wisconsin, why they put all this money in there so they could buy up the power plants.
Mm-hmm.
And control like Enron did back in the early 90s. And I think the more we get to talk like that out and how the corporations are manipulating, and I really feel it's antitrust what they're doing to this country.
Yeah.
There's a way to.
Yeah, no, I'm absolutely with you, Bernie. Thank you very much for the call, and you said it very well. We do need to be calling them out on this more and more and more, and you will hear it a lot on this program. Sherry in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hey, Sherry, what's up?
Good afternoon. Always good to have time to get to see your program.
Thank you.
I have been reading a lot and studying a lot and have a lot more to study, but it seems to me that the real core problem in the country right now are corporations, the way they're structured.
Mm-hmm. That being,
and weren't they initially, if you wanted to form a corporation, it had to be under federal mandates only?
No,
through all these states.
No, actually, the word corporation doesn't exist in the Constitution. They wanted it kept at the state level so that corporations could be kept a close eye on. There were a couple of federal corporations, but they all had to come into being by acts of Congress. And in fact, there are several federally chartered corporations. But the the real basis of it was to keep it at the state level. What it used to be was that a corporation couldn't exist for more than 20 to 30 years in every state in the union until the 1890s. It could only exist for a single purpose. It couldn't own stock in other corporations. Its stockholders and its officers were limited in their financial liability, but not in their criminal liability for acts by the corporation, and they could be directly sued. Corporations every year had to have their books had to be open to the Secretary of State, and in some states they had to be open to the public. And every year the Secretary of State had to evaluate whether the corporation was operating the public good, and if not, they closed them down. And every corporation in every state's corporate charter laws, this was all up until the 1890s, required that the first article in the Articles of Incorporation state that the purpose of the corporation is to operate in the best interests of the citizens of the state. And if they
failed... And that's what I'm talking about.
Right. If they failed to do that, they got the corporate death penalty. They were taken out. So we need
that's
to...
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I strongly think that we need to change our corporate laws, our corporate charter laws. And that has to happen at the state level. Although the Supreme Court has really hurt this in a big way in a whole series of decisions. And that's why Tom Lindsay, we had him on TV yesterday on radio yesterday with CELDEF, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDF.org. Tom Lindsay is doing such great work, and it's important for people to know about it and support it. And the people over at movetoamend.org, who want to amend the Constitution to say, corporations aren't people, money isn't speech. Let's strip out some of this corporate power, because it is corrupting our body politic. It is
not only just the politics, but they're in the military and everything else.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Sherry, thank you so much for the call. And be sure and get over to freespeech.org and sign the petition. It's right there on the front page. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We will be back with more of your calls and thoughts and a fascinating story here about Ronald Reagan and the battle that's going on over Ronald Reagan.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, also our cheesy news alert. Perry outlines bold proposal to repeal the... Well, I'll tell you about it.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
You tell him, Leonard. Isn't it ironic that he's a... Maybe he became an American citizen. I don't know. He's born in Canada. Anyway, our cheesy news alert for the day, with a tip of the hat and many thanks to Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com, the source of this news. Texas today unveiled an ambitious plan to cut trillions from the federal budget by repealing the 20th century. The GOP frontrunner Rick Perry said wasteful programs such as Medicare, Social Security, and school lunches for poor children all got their start in that infernal century. He spoke to an enthusiastic crowd of supporters in Austin, said, "So, if you want to cut the budget, the only way to do that is for every man, woman, and child in this country to travel back in time." While acknowledging that his proposal was unorthodox, Governor Perry said he was confident that time travel was possible because, he said, "I saw Superman do it in a movie one time, and I got someone even mightier than Superman to help me out with this, a fellow by the name of God." Governor Perry said that at an appointed time, he would ask every American to pray to God to send the country back to the 19th century. Said Perry, "Basically, you just need to click your heels together and say there's no place like home." Presidential hopeful said he knew that critics would be skeptical of his plan, but added that he was living proof that it was possible to travel back in time. For example, he said, "My haircut is from 1975. Shortly after his speech, rival candidate Representative Michelle Bachmann, a Republican from Minnesota, blasted Governor Perry for borrowing from her own plan to take the country back to the Middle Ages. But in a positive piece of news for the Texas governor, a new poll shows him leading the pack among voters who describe themselves as delusional. Yeah. 866-987-THOM. Our telephone number, speaking of Governor Perry, is it Deidre? Do I have that right?
Yeah.
In Congress, Arizona. Hey, Deidre, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, what's up? Thanks for calling. You are on the air.
Okay. It was about Rick Perry and his religious beliefs back there in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
these religious preachers that they have on the radio in Texas, he takes from, like Hagee and some others, I can't remember their names and what they preach, but he's this far, far right wing religious
right.
belief. And he wants, he was talking in a speech in Texas about the seven mountains they want to conquer. And one of them is government, where he wants to add religion and more religion into government.
Right, and that's a metaphor right out of, in the Old Testament, the seven hills, you know, and in the New Testament,
yeah,
the seven horns.
Yeah, he said seven mountains, though.
Yeah.
And arts and entertainment is another thing they want to get this stuff into, and education. And I can't remember all the rest.
I agree with you, and thank you very much for the call, Deidre, and making the point that this guy is toxic. Well, we'll see tonight. We'll see how he performs. Fred in St. Augustine, Florida. Hey, Fred, what's up?
I got a question.
Sure.
You were saying in that Dodge decision, you know, that Ford basically won, I guess, because he showed he was actually looking out for the shareholders
and
not hurting.
That's my recollection. It's been at least a decade since I read the, you know, the history of that. But I believe so, yeah.
Well, here's my general question on that. Now, if corporations today give money to politicians, and the politicians say that they don't give any special treatment for this money, they're still just doing their job. So why wouldn't it be against the shareholders to just give away money if they're not getting any return?
Because... Wait a minute. Why would it be a violation of the corporate charter to give away money? I mean, the corporations justify acts of philanthropy, for example, you know, naming giving out Christmas gifts, as long as they get publicity for it by saying, you know, this is going to cause people to like us and buy our products. So is that what you're talking about?
No, I was talking about actually when they give it to a politician.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're not getting any publicity for giving it to a politician. In my mind, if the politician isn't giving them anything in return, they're doing what Dodge was saying Ford was doing. They're just giving away money and not looking out for the shareholders.
Oh, yeah. Well, they are definitely getting something in return, and everybody knows it. And
but they say they're not.
Yeah, you're right. They are.
Somebody's lying there.
Yep. You just nailed it, Fred. You just nailed it. Thank you very much. Richard in Mesa. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey, I have an idea to float by you. How
yeah.
about a constitutional amendment to require people to vote?
I'm not totally opposed to that. The way that they do it in Australia is that if you don't vote, you get about a $25, the equivalent of a traffic ticket. And then every time after that you don't vote, the amount that you get fined goes up, and it starts going up rather quickly and rather exponentially. And so the voter compliance in Australian elections is well over 95%. I believe it's 98%. A system like that, I think, would be actually very good and healthy for the United States. It seems to have worked well for Australia, although I doubt it would pass muster with the Supreme Court. But like you said, if it was done as an amendment to the Constitution, they'd have no say in it. Thanks a lot for the call, and Richard, I appreciate it. Dave in Granby, Mass. We have a minute to the end of the show. Dave, what's up?
Hi. Yeah, I love your show and I love your work, but I had a minor disagreement on the meaning of Ford versus Dodge.
Go for it.
As I read about the case, and I'm not an expert, but it seemed to me to have more to do with the differences in the way that common stock versus preferred stockholders were treated in board meetings. And there's a case in business law called Schlensky versus Wrigley. That's Wrigley as in the Wrigley Field
right.
in Chicago.
And the gum.
The shareholders sued the Wrigley family because Wrigley wouldn't put lights in Wrigley Field, and thereby cutting back on the profits that could be made. And the Wrigley family won that case in court because the court said that they were not obligated to do everything that they could in order to maximize profits.
Oh, that's interesting. Was this at the United States Supreme Court?
No, I believe it was in Illinois.
Yeah, Illinois Supreme Court. Yeah, I mean this case was in the Michigan Supreme Court. So, David, I'll have to look into it. But thank you very much for that. It may well have had to do with different levels of stock. But that was the carry home message for most people was that. Coming up tomorrow, why do some conservatives think that registering the poor to vote is un-American? I'll confront conservative investigative journalist Matthew Vadim. Plus, the headline reads, oil exploration under the Arctic could cause uncontrollable natural disaster. Cambridge University's professor Petum Wedham speaks out. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.